Our first reading, as Connie mentioned, is not Matthew, but Genesis chapter 50, verses 15 through 21. It's on pages 41 to 42 in the Pew Bible. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph, saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of God, the God of your father." When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Our second reading is from Romans chapter 8, verses 22 through 30. It's on page 862. We know that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved, but hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groans that words cannot express. And he who searches our hearts knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints in accordance with God's will. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the likeness of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified.
Please join me in a moment of prayer. O loving God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts together be acceptable in your sight, my rock and my redeemer. Amen. This year marks the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's highly controversial and monumentally important act of nailing his 95 theses on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church in Europe. He raised some pretty interesting questions about where the church was going at that point, questions that even in this day still seem to cry for answers at times. But there's one question that's asked over and over again, not only by theologians, but by men and women, young and old, laity and ministers, including me, and perhaps you. It's not an intellectual question, but a heartfelt and sometimes heartbreaking one. The question is this: is it God's will? It's a question that pops up in the most curious of places at times. Consider what happened a little over 30 years ago in York, England. According to official meteorological reports, a cloud formation moved across that ancient city in the early morning hours of July 9th, 1984. It hovered over York for just about 15 minutes and unleashed a bolt of lightning on the cathedral. The force of that lightning shattered the 13th century oak beams in the sanctuary, and it brought a large chunk of the roof down onto the slate, and it burst into flames. Then the cloud headed out to sea. Now, if that's all there was to the story, it would just be a sad tale. But here is the curious twist. Some Anglicans have argued from that day, quite seriously, that the York fire was divine retribution. You see, the argument holds that God was angered by the consecration in York just 3 days before the Reverend David Jenkins as the Bishop of Durham. You see, it seems that Reverend Jenkins had publicly stated that he doubted whether the virgin birth or the resurrection were actual historical events. So some believe that God sent lightning as punishment. Now, said one vicar from a nearby church, "I'm just very sad that a historical building had to be damaged." And the question still lingers over the incident. Was it God's will? Does God send lightning bolts as punishing messengers? Does God destroy cathedrals to get a point across? Well, in my way of thinking, this instance is kind of odd and quirky, and it makes it a little easier to address about whether it's God's will or not. I really don't believe that God sends lightning bolts as a punishment for heresy. If that were the case, there would be few churches left standing. God does not destroy cathedrals to punish doubting believers any more than God sends airplanes crashing into the Twin Towers to punish an increasingly secular society, or cancer to punish its innocent victims. But that does not keep us from asking the question about some things that happen in life. Is this God's will? What about when tragedy itself gives us an unexpected gift for which we are very thankful? A businessman has been keeping a breakneck pace at work, rushing from this to that, sleep deprived, and in spite of physicians' warnings and the pleadings of his family, he just can't seem to slow down. Then one day, he suffers a heart attack. He finds that he must slow down, and he discovers that there are a lot of quieter moments in life, and that he's been missing the satisfaction of watching his children grow up and the relationship with his wife and friends. None of that would have been possible without the heart attack. Was the heart attack God's way of getting his attention? Or how about the man who, from the time he was a teen, was too often on the wrong side of the law? He was a bully in school, drank himself through college, was abusive to his wife, and rarely held a job for more than a year. One day, after being fired from yet another job, he got in his car, headed down the highway much too fast, missed a sharp turn, and crashed into a large oak tree. He survived briefly, but died in the hospital emergency room shortly after arrival. His wife authorized the harvesting of any organs that could be utilized, and as a result of that, three people got a new lease on life. Corneas restoring eyesight, a heart for a brilliant teen who had a congenital defect, and a kidney for a young woman who had been on dialysis for nearly a year. She had three children. Was it God's will that a man of questionable values and unacceptable behaviors die so that others who had the potential to contribute more productively to society could live? Or consider the story of Joseph and his brothers. I didn't have Tom read you the whole story today. It would have taken up most of the hour. But I'll give you sort of the Reader's Digest condensed version of what had gone on before that final episode. Joseph was the youngest of many brothers and his father's favorite. As if that weren't enough to anger his brothers, Joseph was also a dreamer of vivid dreams in which it just so happened he always came out as the hero. And the next morning at the breakfast table, he felt compelled to share all the wonderful details of these dreams. So when his brothers had finally decided that enough is enough, they considered murdering him. Ultimately, they simply threw him into a well. And then they had second thoughts about that, so they pulled him out and sold him into slavery, telling his father that he had been killed by a wild animal. After this, some time passed, and unbeknownst to his family, that while he was serving as a slave in Egypt, Joseph once again developed quite a reputation about his dreams, only this time his dreams seemed to be foretelling the future. Now, this was a valuable insight for a king to have, so the king made him his right-hand man. Then, years later, Joseph's brothers came to Egypt looking for food because there was a great famine in their land. They came to the palace, and as it turned out, they were making their plea directly to their brother Joseph, but they didn't recognize him. Now, I don't know if this was because he was dressed in Egyptian finery, whether he developed a heavy Egyptian accent, or just they could not imagine that their brother, whom they had sold into slavery, would be elevated to such a position of power and authority. Well, since they didn't recognize him, Joseph decided to get a little revenge and have a bit of fun with them. So he gave them the food they asked for, but asked the men who were filling the bags to also put in a valuable silver cup. And as they started to leave the kingdom, they were arrested for robbery. Well, Joseph toyed with them a bit, and when he finally had accomplished his goal, he told his brothers who he was, and they all embraced one another, and a new relationship had begun. But the real moment of truth came when their father, Jacob, died. Generous and forgiving as Joseph had been, his brothers couldn't avoid the nasty suspicion that once Daddy wasn't around to serve as an incentive for good behavior, well, Joseph might not treat his brothers so well. He might start reflecting back on the way things had been, the pit, his years as a slave, and decide to really pay them back. So they went to see him, fell on their knees, and begged his pardon. And when they did, Joseph said the most remarkable thing. He said, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Is Joseph saying that everything that happened was God's will? That God had designed this whole soap opera, the betrayal, the pit, the slavery, the famine? Was all of that God's will? Is that what Joseph meant when he said, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good"? When Joseph's brothers thought they were following their own twisted way, could it be they were unknowingly following God's straight path all along? Was everything that happened, no matter how cruel, actually an expression of God's love and will in order that ultimately the family could survive the tough times that lay ahead? I don't think so. And here is where we get to an important distinction and really the heart of what I want you to remember about today's message. It's summed up in this quote from Reinhold Niebuhr: "God does not will everything that happens, but God does will good out of everything that happens." Let me read that again. God does not will everything that happens, but God does will good out of everything that happens. Consider the implications of that statement. God does not will that brothers try to kill one another, or that one brother must be sold into slavery just so the relationship can be healed. Rather, given that Joseph's brothers have tried to kill him and that he has been sold into slavery, God wills good to come out of that situation. Paul states this truth simply and profoundly. He writes to the Romans, "We know that in everything, God works for good with those who love him." Notice that first, Paul does not say everything is good or that everything that happens is God's will. Paul has seen enough of life and way too much of the dark side of life to contend that things always turn out for the best. But even in the worst of circumstances, good is possible. But neither does Paul say that good will always come out of a bad situation, as if it happens automatically to balance some sort of cosmic good and evil model. No, he says, in everything, God works for good with those who love him. It is God's power that can bring good out of evil, triumph out of defeat. This is not a simplistic, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. This is about a partnership in which we become conduits, co-creators, servants, whatever you want to call it, but we become God's hands and feet and voices and hearts in the world. With God's help, we can take a bad situation and transform it into a powerful force for hope and healing and good. God's will is to be that kind of a partner in our life, the kind of partner who redeems even lost causes, who in the mystery of holy love transforms hate into an opportunity for love and tragedy into the raw material for triumph. This is a profound view of life. On one hand, it's tough-minded and realistic. It takes our experience of sorrow and evil seriously. It does not ask us to view those experiences as anything less than they are. And yet, this is also a positive and a hopeful view. For we can affirm that with God, there is no sorrow too great that it can't be transformed, no evil so powerful it cannot be redeemed, no tragedy so complete that good cannot come out of it. Racism, greed, war, famine, cancer, dementia, abuse, senseless violence in Las Vegas and on college campuses, devastation in Puerto Rico, and the opioid epidemic are real. But with God, so is hope. Tragedy is possible. Our own life experiences tell us so. But in partnership with God, we can make sure that tragedy does not have the last word. "We know," said Paul, with the confidence of one who knew great sorrow and adversity, "we know that in everything, God works for good with those who love him." There's a legend that there are two copies of an ancient map, the original of which was drawn up during the reign of Henry V in the 15th century. At that time, people knew relatively little about the sea, and most people who did create maps or sail the seas sensed that out there, there were things to be feared, monsters that would swallow ships that ventured too close. Well, it seems that whoever created this particular map had that belief as well, because in various places on the map where there are seas, it's written, "Here be monsters, here be dragons, here be serpents. But someone got a hold of one of these maps, and that person must have been someone who, in addition to being a navigator, was a person of faith. For wherever there was a notion about monsters or serpents and demons, they had written in bold letters, 'Here be God.'" It strikes me, as we attempt to navigate our own way on this journey we call life, we can choose to use one kind of map or the other. We can choose to see Only the perilous seas filled with monsters and demons, occasions for sorrow and tragedy. Or we can choose to use the other map that recognizes each of those experiences in life by noting the presence of monsters and demons, but which also recognizes the possibility of God to be discovered, for God's name to be written with boldness, to transform even the most perilous of waters into an occasion for the triumph of love and grace. What are the monsters or monstrous circumstances that imperil your life? Are they loneliness or depression, disease or physical limitations, financial woes or family concerns, fear of violence or environmental catastrophe? Recognize them, not as manifestations of God's will, but recognize them as opportunities for transformation, for God's will to be done. With God as our partner, that is possible. Amen.